Welcome to Wall Street Unspun with your host, Peter Schiff.
But it's a giant bubble in search of a pin, and it's going to find
one. Are you confused with the ups and downs in the economy and what it means to you?
Don't believe the propaganda, and that's what it is. When you're listening to an analyst on a lot of these popular financial shows, you're not getting investment advice. You're getting propaganda.
Get ready to untangle the web of misinformation provided by the mainstream media.
These firms are trying to sell you stocks. Their real clients, their banking clients, are trying to get rid of stuff.
And now, here's your host of Wall Street Unspun, the president of Euro Pacific Capital and a licensed broker with a passion for truth. Wall Street Unspun with Peter Schiff.
Hello, everybody. It's Peter Schiff. Another live episode of Wall Street Unspun, midweek market update. This is Wednesday, August 11th, 2010. We're doing this show on Wednesday evenings live. I should be able to do most of them myself now. We do it on shortwave radio at 5.07 megahertz and on my website, europac.net. You can also call in 888-678-9597, 888-678-9597 if you have a question. Anyway, as most of you probably know, the primary election in Connecticut was held yesterday, and I did not win, so I am no longer a candidate for the U.S. Senate. You know, I recorded a video blog on my website on both Schiff for Senate, I mean the YouTube channel, and my Schiff Report channel, so you can listen to that, get some more of my reaction. But, you know, the race was, you know, I did better than people thought I was going to do. I ended up with 23% of the vote. Rob Simmons got 28. Linda McMahon got 49. The main problem I had really was a lack of media coverage. I mean, that was really the biggest frustration of this campaign, was the inability to get mentioned or get invited to appear on any news program. It would have certainly helped a lot. I mean, I moved up 10 points in the last week, or last month rather, of the polls from 13% to 23%. You know, without my name even being spoken. It's like, you know, there's seven words that you can't say on television. Well, during the Senate campaign, there was actually an eighth word, and it was Peter Schiff. You weren't allowed to say the name Peter Schiff if you were talking about the Senate race in Connecticut. I mean, nobody would mention me. I mean, you'd see all this coverage of the Senate race, and it would be Linda McMahon or Linda McMahon, Rob Simmons. That was it. So it was difficult for me to gain more momentum when people didn't know I was in a race. It's hard to raise money when people don't see the reporters covering you. They just assume that you're not viable. You know, only 49% of the Republican voters had heard about me on Election Day, and I still got 23% of the vote, which is, as a percentage of the people who knew my name, that was pretty good. And unfortunately, you know, all the anti-Linda votes mainly went to Rob Simmons, because they knew his name. He got a lot more press than me, and of course, he had been familiar. He had been in government for 16 years here in Connecticut, 6 years in Congress, and 10 years in the state legislature. So if you didn't like Linda, you voted for Rob. But all my votes were people who actually knew about me, sought me out, and voted for me. I got no real free media. And, you know, it's a shame. I wonder what would have happened if the media would have covered me. CNN, particularly Fox News, you know, some of the networks, if they'd have told my story about how I petitioned on the ballot, how I got the backing of all the Tea Parties, how I predicted the financial crisis, how I got, you know, how I got famous, and how people drafted me. I mean, it's a very compelling story. It's far more compelling than the McMahon story. And, you know, I could have caught on. I mean, I probably could have won the race if I got some media. And, you know, maybe to some people it sounds like sour grapes, but, you know, I couldn't get any media. You know, every time I did get booked on Fox, they canceled it. Or CNBC, they canceled like 15 shows in a row in the last month and a half. I couldn't get on. If someone booked it, it got canceled. You know, the Wall Street Journal actually sent a reporter to cover me. And they spent, you know, a long time at my house. They followed me around to my office, to my campaign headquarters. They took all kinds of footage. They sent the reporters back. I did on-tape interviews. They finished the whole thing about 10 days ago or 2 weeks ago. And they still haven't come out with a story. It's a big profile piece on me. It was supposed to come out before the primary. It hasn't even come out yet. I guess they decided to hold off. They didn't want to give me any publicity before the race. You know, one time Fox sent a camera crew out to interview me. Great footage, great stuff. The reporter loved it, interviewed me, followed me around, interviewed people I talked to. Never used any of it. Not a word of what I said ever made it on Fox News. It was supposed to be a whole thing on me, and they canceled it. You know, so when they did do something, they canceled it. Most of the time, they wouldn't even have me on. So, you know, who knows? And it wasn't just one news station. It was all the news stations. But in any event, the fact that I was able to do so much better than people thought, I mean, I didn't get 5% or 8%. I got 23%. Rob Simmons only beat me by 5 points. And in fact, in most of the towns outside of his district where he served, I came in second to Linda. And, of course, how did Linda McMahon beat me? She outspent me by more than $20 million, more than $20 million. She spent more than any candidate who would ever, in Connecticut history in a whole race by far, wouldn't even close. And this is a tiny state. She spent more than any Republican in the country, any Democrat, any candidate. And on top of that, on top of all the media she bought, she got tons of free press. I couldn't get any of that. So it was a huge advantage, and yet she still couldn't even get over 50% of the vote. Yeah, she got 49%, but between me and Rob, we got more. You know, even though between the two of us, we spent a lot less and got a lot less publicity. But anyway, race is over. Whether I do something in 2012 or some year after that, who knows? I think that, you know, I think that I have some type of influence now, I think, in Connecticut, in the Republican Party, whatever that's worth. I mean, there are a lot of people now in the Republican Party, you know, close to 30,000 people voted for me. And, you know, that's something. And so we'll see what happens with that. But I thank everybody, you know, everybody who's listened to this show, who phone banked for us. You know, we made 200,000 phone calls in that final month. And that was certainly probably unprecedented. Nobody even covered that. You figure that's a story all by itself. Thank the people that called. I thank the people who donated. And, you know, I'm still accepting donations. The reason I'm doing that is the campaign still has an office for the next few months. My lease isn't up. I still have to send out a lot of T-shirts. I've signed a bunch of them. There's more we got to send up. We're backed up. I got a lot of books to send out. Loose ends to tie up. I think we're going to, you know, have a couple of people there for a while. And so it'd be nice to get some money coming in to keep the expenses going. And what I am doing, you know, we got rid of a couple of hundred, maybe 250 already, of my father's three economics books based on the donations that we've had. These are great, great books. I love these books. How an Economy Grows and Why It Doesn't, The Kingdom of Malts, and The Biggest Con. These are fantastic, incredible books. If you want to know, you know, where I got my economics from, how I learned it from my dad, and here's his book. So I still have more copies left. Originally, I was giving away these copies with $200 donations. Since the campaign is over, I obviously don't need as much money. I've lowered the bar. So for a $125 donation, I'll give you all three of these books as a thank you for making a donation. And so you can still make the donations on shiftforsenate.com website, or, you know, send in a check, and you know, money will be appreciated to keep this thing going as we wind it down. And of course, if there's any money left over, you know, it could give me a head start on 2012 should I decide to repeat this again. The good news is that, you know, when I started this race, I had zero name recognition. Nobody, I mean, maybe 2%. That was it. No one knew who I was. Now I've got 50% name recognition. So, you know, you probably can't win with 50%, but it's certainly a great place to start. It's something to build on. And certainly all the establishment people in Connecticut know who I am. And I'm sure they respect me a lot now based on what I was able to accomplish despite all of the obstacles put in my path by the Republican Party and by the mainstream media. Anyway, the markets have been very interesting. Big down day in the stock market today. Dollar finally had a big up day. It had been falling for 9 consecutive weeks. We'll see if this can be the first week in 10 that it goes up. It's off to a big start. I don't think it's going to have much more of a rally. I did say on my last video blog, or maybe on this show, that I thought the dollar index was due for a bounce, especially when it got close to that 80 level. I thought it would move up around 82. And that's what happened. It got down to about 80.10, and now it's about 82.5-ish. So We got that. And the dollar is rallying because of this double dip fear. The stock market's getting killed, down about 260 today. You know, the Fed, as I predicted a year ago, the Fed is backing out of its exit strategy. Oh, we can't exit. You know, we're not going to shrink the balance sheet. We're not going to we're going to buy more treasuries when our mortgage securities mature. And of course, they're not just going to hold the balance sheet stable. They are going to continue to expand it. They have to. They have no choice if they want to keep this bubble economy inflated. Now, that's the wrong thing to do. The Fed needs to allow the bubble to deflate. We need to cure this economy. We need to stop consuming. You know, we had a trade deficit came out today. It was the biggest increase in 1 month since they started keeping records back in 1992. This means the economy is getting sicker. I mean, if we have a $50 billion trade deficit when GDP growth is anemic, I mean, if they did get this phony economy going again, if they got us all back in the mall shopping, where would the trade deficit go? I mean, this shows you that the real economy is contracting. We're consuming more, but we're not producing enough to meet that demand. We're importing it. That subtracts from real GDP. It puts more dollars into global circulation. It puts more downward pressure on our currency. It's more inflation. This is a disaster. And, you know, people are thinking, oh, is there going to be a double dip? I mean, how clueless are these people? The recession never ended. It was interrupted by a spending spree financed with debt that only weakened the economy. And, of course, as the spending stops, you know, the mistakes are revealed and the economic contraction continues. And what can the Fed do? Nothing. And the longer they keep interest rates artificially low, the worse they make the economy. Because what's going on? All that we have is the banks are recycling money they get from the Fed to the Treasury. Meanwhile, no businesses are being expanded. There is no credit. There's no money to expand our manufacturing base. So we grow more and more dependent on foreign production and foreign capital. I mean, this is a disaster. And, you know, we're getting more data. Data is starting to come back down, which we need. Prices are still too high. So what is Obama talking about now? More housing bailout, more money for people who can't make their mortgage payments. You know, more ways to try to, you know, prop this thing up. Let's put Band-Aids on this cancer so that we don't have to see it spreading. You know, that is the wrong thing to do. You know, you treat a cancer. You don't hide it. You don't wait till you die from it, which is exactly what we are doing. And, you know, we are setting this thing up. I mean, the fact that the bond market, look at the yield on bonds. You know, I'm watching CNBC today and watching Kudlow. And, you know, maybe one of the reasons that I have a hard time getting on these shows now, apart from the fact that I was a Senate candidate. In fact, you know, CNN finally called to book me today. I'm booked on CNN on Friday to talk about the housing market. I can't remember the last time I did CNN. But, you know, I don't know if it's related to the fact that I'm no longer a candidate. But anyway, I will be on, unless it gets canceled last minute. I am booked on CNN Friday to talk about the housing market. Now I lost my train of thought. I don't even remember what I was talking about. Let me see if I can. I don't know if anybody, I don't know. I just lost my, my train of thought. I know I was talking something about the economy. Oh, okay. Yeah. On CNBC. So I think one of the reasons they don't like me on there is because when they say something really stupid and I'm on the air, you know, it might come back in some later montage video because there are a lot of people that are recording this stuff. And so, you know, when I'm not there, whatever they say that's stupid, you know, is pretty much lost. You know, it's not going to come back. But if they say it next to me, but these guys are all talking about how great these low interest rates are and it's great for stocks. And, you know, low interest rates are good if they result from high savings, you know, if they're legitimate, high savings, low inflation, sound money. But when they're artificial and unsustainable and temporary, they're a disaster because they encourage people to borrow a lot of money. But then when rates go up, they have to default. I mean, that's what Greece did. I mean, history is littered with the ashes of people who took on too much debt when rates were low. I mean, we just experienced this in subprime. What were teaser rates about? Yes, buy a house. Take advantage of these temporarily low rates. It allows you to leverage up because you can afford the teaser rate. Well, what happened when rates went up? I mean, how can people be so clueless as to not see that this is a trap? This is a, you know, it's borrowing money now because it's cheap is a disaster. And the Fed knows this because everybody is doing it. The government is doing it. You know, all the national debt is financed short term. And this puts the Fed in a position where it can never raise rates, which I've been saying for years. All they do is pretend and talk. We got an exit strategy. They have nothing. They have absolutely nothing. They are going to keep rates low. They are going to keep printing money until this whole house of cards comes tumbling down. And we have the biggest financial disaster in our history. And what we had in 2008 was nothing. It was the tip of a huge iceberg, and that iceberg is coming. It's all beneath the surface. The Fed is burying it, but one of these days, and one of these days soon, it is going to surface, and it's the mother of all of financial crises. And what you've got to do is make sure that you are invested properly before this happens. Because if you're trying to finesse this thing, if you're trying to, you know, short-term time it because you think you can do it, I think you're playing with fire. Now, speaking about short-term timing, and before I take your calls, I got to mention this because I just get such a kick out of this guy. A lot of you know Mike Norman is the guy that's laughing hysterically on YouTube when I'm saying that the housing market's going to go down and all this, and he's like, he's a guy laughing at me. And there's another guy on there, Tom Atkins, this guy that I think was married to Brenda Butner from Fox, and I think he got kicked off Fox News. I haven't seen him on in years, but he had the long hair. I was a real estate guy. He's the other guy that said real estate market prices go up 10% because that's about normal. You know, prices always go up 10%. That's how real estate is. Anyway, so these guys were obviously very pissed off at me because of the Peter Schiff Was Right video, which I had nothing to do with producing. I mean, it just happens to be out there. And so, and Norman never, I mean, Norman tries to find ways to knock me anywhere he can. So the latest attempt by these two guys to get me is they produce this YouTube video and they claim I'm a complete fraud. And what they're saying is, look at how lousy my stock picks have done. I'm the worst stock picker in the world. You're better off just throwing darts. And so Peter Schiff's a complete fraud and a moron. Now, what did they do? What's their evidence for this? Well, what they did is they apparently took the stocks that I recommended on television, right, just on television, between January 07 and August 08, okay, just that one time period. So that's like the peak of the market. During that year and a half is where, like, the market kind of was at the highs, especially the types of stocks that I had recommended, which were all gold and oil stocks. Now, the reason I recommended gold and oil stocks was because when I went on these TV shows and they wanted stock picks, I couldn't give them the foreign stocks. I had to give them stocks that were listed in the U.S. So the only stocks that I was really buying in the U.S. were oil stocks and gold stocks. So that's what I mentioned. And sometimes, you know, a couple of was an ag stock or a couple, but it was all resources, and they're all big stocks because they had to be liquid. So they're not necessarily my favorite stocks, and it's not a balanced portfolio. They're the stocks that I was able to recommend on these shows. And, of course, they didn't take any of my recommendations from 2005 or 2006, just 07 through mid-08. And anyway, he lists all these stocks and shows how much they're down. Now, some of them were actually up, so they threw a couple of stocks that were up, but they weren't up big. But the time period they picked, they stopped at December 08, like, you know, the bottom of the market, right? And they said, hey, look, the Dow Jones was down 25% or, you know, during this period of time from, you know, if you'd have bought the Dow every time Schiff said buy one of these stocks, but if you bought these stocks, you're down, I don't know, it was 33%, whatever it was. And so the conclusion is that I'm an idiot, that you could have just thrown darts at a board and been down 25%, but you listened to me and you're down 33%. Now, of course, nobody could be this stupid because you're taking high beta stocks, gold stocks and oil stocks, in a huge down market. Of course these stocks, now high beta stocks are stocks that are more volatile than the market. So gold stocks in particular, when the markets are going down, they're going to go down more. When the markets are going up, they're going up more, which is exactly what happened. But they didn't measure those stock performance until today. No, they cut it off a long time ago, even though they have all the data. And of course, they didn't go back and look at where those stocks were a year or two or three before that those TV shows, because I didn't start buying them when I went on those TV shows. I happened to recommend them when I was on those TV shows, but many of those stocks I had bought 5 years earlier, you know, when they were a lot lower. So they just take this one short window of time and compare high beta stocks to a market average, during a huge downturn. And their conclusion is, I'm an idiot. It's absurd to try to make this. And Norman has to know this. I mean, he's not that stupid. I mean, he's sort of in this business, I guess. I mean, he claims to be, but, you know, I don't really know what the hell the guy does. But, and also, they allege in this video, they say, Peter Schiff refuses to publish his track record. All the other money managers publish their track record, yet Schiff refuses. Well, that's because up until a year ago, I wasn't a money manager. I was a stockbroker. I owned a brokerage firm. And because I'm a stockbroker, I have no track record because I'm not allowed to advertise any performance. In fact, people can always find a Euro Pacific Capital client that's lost money. I've got 17,000 clients. You know, there are people that have lost money, of course. There are people that invested at a bad time and got out at a bad time. And not all my clients even follow my advice. I mean, they can, a lot of them ignore my advice. And sometimes they follow it, sometimes they don't. So the accounts are different. But it's easy to find an account that went down when you have so many accounts. But what I can't do, what I'm prohibited by law from doing, is pointing to any account that went up and saying, here's client John Smith. His account is up X. I can't do that. That's illegal, right? It's not illegal for somebody else to say, here's Peter Schiff's client, Mr. Jones, who lost, you know, X amount. But I can't say, yeah, but here's 1,000 Mr. Smiths that made X. I can't do that. I can't even point to one. I can't legally come up with performance figures for my brokerage clients because it is against industry regulations. But, of course, they don't say that. So they try to imply that I'm hiding my track record because it's really bad, you know. So, I mean, these guys, and so I just thought I'd point it out. I don't know if it goes around Facebook or if it goes around. But, you know, you can't judge any investment strategy during a short-term window. And everybody, right, I could go and say, hey, Warren Buffett is a lousy stock picker. I can show what happened to Warren Buffett stocks between, the ones that he bought in 07 and what they were worth at the end of 09 and show, gee, the guy must be a moron. He's down 50%. He's the biggest idiot there is. He can't pick stocks. He's overrated. I mean, anybody, you can find any period of time. And, you know, when you have a long-term strategy, you know, no stocks go up all the time. Stocks are going to go down. And, of course, you know, they don't even look at during that same period of time, we were advising people to get into a hedge fund that shorted subprime mortgages. So, you know, that was something I was recommending too. So there were things that we did do that actually did well during that time period. But, you know, they don't look at that. You know, they look at the stuff that they want to look at to try to create this false impression that I don't know anything about what I'm talking about. But anyway, I don't know if anybody's seen that, but I just thought it was – I just got a kick out of it. And so I thought I'd mention it. Again, for the regulators – you know, any investing that you do is going to be risky, whether you're following my advice or anybody else's advice. Short-term performance does not guarantee long-term results. So you got to do your own homework. You got to make sure that you understand the risks. And, of course, you know, stocks are volatile. They're, you know, the stocks go up and down, especially now. You have extreme volatility. You can't buy a stock unless you're willing to watch it drop dramatically, you know, because nobody knows. Anything is possible short term. Now, of course, they also try to defend real estate in this clip by saying that if you'd have bought real estate at that time, you're only down 20%. And so even real estate was a better investment than mine because I was down 33%. Now, I take exception with that. Real estate is not down 20%. There are houses that are down 50, 60, 70%. And what's the transaction cost to buy and sell real estate? If you would have bought real estate, you know, in 2007, early 2007, what's that worth in 2010? You know, meanwhile, how much of those stocks that they're saying went down so much, how much have they rebounded? A lot more than real estate, a lot more. I mean, so the whole thing is a complete fraud. Anyway, let me go to the calls. I don't want to dwell on this topic. I got two international callers, so let me take them first. I know that they're both from Australia. First one is Leland. Go ahead.
Hey, yeah, g'day, man. I'm just calling up to find out to get some investment advice from my mother. She's got a block of land in Melbourne that's worth $450,000 US. She wants to kind of preserve her wealth, and she can stay at my grandpa's for like a couple of years. Just essentially sit and so she doesn't have any real costs. I was wondering what investment advice do you have? Yeah.
Well, you know, I'm not as familiar with her. Is it residential property she has there?
Yeah, it's residential. It's just like a quarter acre block kind of thing.
Yeah, I'm, you know, haven't been following the residential market in Australia as much. I mean, I own some commercial property in that part of the world and a lot of other stocks over there. I'm not as worried about Australia. I mean, I'm buying into Australia as kind of a safe haven from the problems here in the U.S. So, but I don't know all the rest of your mother's circumstances as to, you know, the rest of her assets and what she might do.
She's pretty much got no other assets. It's mainly just the house will pretty much be taken down and no doubt redeveloped. So she just pretty much didn't want to lose, you know, sell the property and then simply through inflation lose some money or invest.
Yeah, well, if it's just raw land, I mean, if that's a big asset, it probably makes sense, you know, to try to sell it and be a little bit more diversified and not have everything, you know, all your eggs in one basket. But anyway, if it's something that you want to talk about, you know, with a broker and, you know, you can call us up, you know, off the air. It's just not, probably not that entertaining for the rest of the listeners to try to figure it out.
Yeah, sure thing.
Okay,
sure thing.
All right, but yeah, you can call us up. But yeah, you know, I generally think that it's better to be diversified. And if all your money is in one piece of property and it's just not even developed and you're not even collecting rent, there's probably better things to do. All right.
Okay, thanks.
Take care. Thanks for the call. And the next caller from down under is Mike from Australia as well.
Hi, Peter. Thanks for taking the call. Very, very good to get the opportunity to speak to you. I've just got a quick question. I understand that buying gold from US dollars is a good idea because the economy is obviously fundamentally not sound at all. But what do you think about buying gold from Australian dollars?
Well, I think that gold is going to rise in terms of all of the fiat currencies. So I think that Australians should own gold, you know, as well as Americans and people in other countries. But I do not think that the Australian dollar will lose anywhere near as much value as will the U.S. dollar. So, you know, the gain that you're going to see based on Australian currency, I don't think will be nearly as dramatic as what Americans see. But I still think it makes sense to own. And also, you know, you can own gold in the form of gold mines. There are a lot of gold miners out there in Australia that will be making profits, and they will be more profitable as the price of gold rises in terms of the cost of production. And so I think those investments make sense for Australians, but they make a lot more sense for Americans because we've got a lot more to worry about. You know, our economy is in much, much worse shape. We are looking at the possibility of runaway inflation. Australia is not.
Yeah, sure. Okay, well, thanks very much for the call. And also, I just wanted to say, although you didn't win the Senate, you know, the election, you had a lot of support and you did a really good job, and you're appreciated from all over the world, not only in Connecticut or the United States, but everywhere. And
Thank you very much. Hopefully one day
I'll get to meet you. All right,
sure.
Thanks very much, Peter.
You know, that would have also been, you figured it would be a compelling story. Here I am running for U.S. Senate, never run for office in my life, yet I've got supporters not only all around the country, but all around the world. I mean, my supporters were coming from a much wider spectrum than were Linda McMahon's. I mean, you would think, I mean, one of my volunteers was from Norway. Now, you would think that that's an interesting story. I mean, why is this Norwegian kid volunteering for a Senate race in Connecticut? I mean, not only isn't it his state, it's not even his country. I mean, my campaign spanned the globe in the people that were interested in it. Yet I couldn't even get coverage in my own country. I couldn't get news stations to cover my campaign, despite the fact that it had that much appeal for so many people. I mean, we had almost, 25,000 donors? You know, why do you think that the media would say, hey, you know, this is an interesting story. Why has this guy got such appeal? And, you know, even the fact that I'm the one that was credited with forecasting the economic crisis, you know, I'm the one that was on TV warning about it. I mean, the fact that I'm now running a Senate campaign, I mean, that's an interesting story. I mean, I would think, yet nobody, not one network, thought it was worthy of even covering writing one story about it, not one. Yet there were so many stories about a billionaire wrestling mogul just trying to buy a Senate seat. I mean, what's so, I mean, what's so compelling about that? A billionaire decides to spend $50 million. Yes, okay, it's interesting. But, all right, then where do you go? I think my story was far more interesting from a journalistic perspective, and yet nobody covered it. Anyway, back to the phones. Next up is going to be Kenny in New York. Kenny, you're there.
Hi, Peter. Well, first of all, I want to congratulate you on your progress. You might not have won the primary, but you definitely won a lot of hearts and minds of some dedicated voters.
Thank you.
I have actually two questions for you. The first one is, well, I was phone banking for you on Tuesday, and I was watching for when the Fed released their statement. I saw that exact minute, the price of gold jumped up like almost $9. So, and I know that on that day, a lot of people were expecting the Fed to announce another round of quantitative easing. So, Peter, do you think that we're going to see another quantitative easing round anytime soon?
Well, absolutely. I mean, I said earlier in this show, those are the only arrows in their quiver. The Fed cannot allow market forces to bring interest rates higher, which is what we need. And they will not allow market forces to bring asset prices like stocks lower, which is what we need. See, as again, it's like we are addicted to heroin. The only way to kick the habit is to go through withdrawal, to stop taking the drug. The government will not let that happen because they don't want the withdrawal because the voters find it unpleasant. So the only solution they know is to keep shooting us up with more drugs so that we're always high. And so that's all they're going to do. Now, they're going to pretend otherwise because they don't want to let the cat out of the bag. They can't telegraph this because then the dollar would collapse right now. So they're going to lie until people are smart enough to figure out what they're doing. But it's all politics. It's all about, you know, preventing the collapse from happening today. It's not about making sure it never happens. They're making sure it happens. They're making sure when it happens, it's worse. All they care about is not today. Let's push it. Let's delay the day of reckoning. Not, oh my God, this is a disaster. How can we head it off? No. See, that's why I was running. That was what different about my campaign. I care about the country. I see this disaster coming. I know that the medicine that we have to swallow is bitter. I know that, but I know it will work. I know it will head off the fatal disease that we have and that the government is perpetuating. And unfortunately, you know, I am right on this. And when I am proven right on this, you know, and it is a complete disaster, believe me, I'm not going to be happy about it. You know, I wish I could be wrong. I really wish I could be wrong. I wish our leaders could do the right thing. But alas, I have very little confidence that they will.
Peter, could you also answer another?
Go ahead.
Okay. So I've been following the precious metals market, and I've read a lot of stories about manipulation in the gold and silver markets by J.P. Morgan and some other corporations, usually around options expiry. Any comments on that?
Oh, look, I mean, I'm not one to think that there are conspiracies, although you might have thought there was a conspiracy, not to mention my name in connection with the Connecticut Senate race. But again, I don't think there's a conspiracy, but, you know, sometimes things certainly look that way. And I know that the government has a vested interest in keeping the price of gold down. But what it actually does to suppress it covertly in cooperation with other entities, you know, I don't know, and I kind of doubt that. But they certainly try to talk the price of gold down. Central banks certainly sell gold to try to keep the price down. But I don't know that it's any kind of conspiracy. It's just something that they're doing. But anyway, thank you for the call.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you. Next up, one of my potential or a potential constituent, had I won, but potentially one of my voters, Jeff calling from Connecticut. Go ahead, Jeff.
Hey, Peter, how are you? I just want to comment on the real estate market and basically how right you were. I have two neighbors, one of which owns $680,000 on his home that's now worth $300,000. He Been living there for 2 years free without paying his mortgage, taxes, or homeowners. After 2 years, he called up Bank of America and told them that he was moving out of the house. Bank of America advised him that he could not do that, that he had to stay there for at least another 6 months while they tried to sell the property. And then my other next-door neighbor owes $550 on his house. It's worth around $300. He hasn't worked in 2 years. He's been collecting unemployment. I'm just wondering, when are the banks going to realize, or should I say government, going to realize that they're, you know, you're right and they're wrong?
Look, if they realize it or not, they're never going to admit it. And, you know, instead of these guys like these Mike Normans, you know, just trying to figure out how to poke holes in my stock picking, you know, why don't they at least acknowledge how right I was on the housing market? They still haven't done that. If you haven't seen, you know, my mortgage banker's speech, just watch that speech or read Crash Proof or read my commentaries from 2004 to 2000. I mean, I hit every nail on the head. I have not run into anybody in this country who better outlined the problems in the housing market from every angle that I did. And, you know, even if I got other things wrong, that one call was so accurate and so correct. The fact that, you know, the fact that more people refuse to acknowledge, especially when I was so alone in that, I took so much heat, even though I was so specific in how I outlined it and described it. And in hindsight, it seems so obvious to everybody. Believe me, at the time, it was obvious to nobody. I was a lone voice. If you haven't seen that, you know, go on YouTube, Peter Schiff Mortgage Bankers. You know, watch that whole speech. I have it on one a YouTube clip. Have you seen that one?
It's a great video. But it's just becoming very frustrating to sit here and see my next-door neighbor sit on his deck and drink martinis and eat lobster when he hasn't made a mortgage payment in 2 years.
And speaking about unemployment, you know, I got into an argument with one of these guys on one of the editorial boards or one of these newspapers that didn't endorse me about unemployment. And I said I would not vote to extend the unemployment benefits. And I said that a lot of people were choosing unemployment over work. And they said, oh, that would never happen. That's impossible. That's heartless. I mean, that nobody would take an unemployment check if they. And I tried to explain that. And there was just an article in the Wall Street Journal a couple days ago that said that employers were having a difficult time hiring. Many jobs were going unfilled. And the main reason was people didn't want the jobs because they didn't want to lose their unemployment benefits. If you pay people not to work, that's a lot more enticing than being paid to work. Because believe me, for most people, not working is better than working. It's more fun. So if you can get paid not to work, if you can get paid to lie on the beach and hang out with your family and maybe take a trip and enjoy your life, if you can get paid for that, you know, rather than showing up at some boring, mundane job to collect a low. I mean, and that is what we've created. We've created a culture of dependency. We've basically turned unemployment into early retirement is what we've done. And no one wants to admit that. No one wants to be accused of being heartless to the unemployed. So we are going to be extending those unemployment benefits indefinitely. Indefinitely. Nope, because not one politician in Washington has the guts to oppose extending unemployment benefits. Nobody will cut anything for anybody. These guys are gutless, right? All they care about is getting reelected, and they don't care. They don't care how they destroy this country. As long as they're elected, as long as they're in power, when the country goes down the drain, that's fine with them.
And the other situation we have, it's becoming an epidemic where people just quit making their mortgage payment to get the bank to negotiate at these 2% interest rates.
Well, of course, that's the moral hazard. Don't pay your mortgage. Don't pay your credit card bills. Don't pay your auto loan. Wait for a bailout. Don't pay your student loan. Don't work. Just live off the government. That is what we are doing. We are destroying all the free market-based incentives that made the country rich, and we are adopting all of the bad socialist incentives or distance that bankrupted everybody else.
Well, Peter, great job. I really appreciate what you do. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Jeff, for calling for me. Did you vote for me?
Of course I did, yes. You're the best, Peter. Hope to see
you in
2012.
Yeah, you know, some of my supporters emailed me. They went to vote for me, and they couldn't because they forgot to register Republican. They realized they were independent or they hadn't changed. So, Anyway, next caller is Bob in Virginia.
Sir?
Peter. Hey, how are you?
Good, sir. How are you?
Good.
I got two questions, one of which, if you could put a one-year or six-month window on when this economy might unravel, when would you say it would be?
I think it's already unraveling. I mean, this is what it looks like. The question is, when will the pace of the unraveling pick up? I mean, the real danger comes when the bond market starts to fall, the dollar starts to collapse, interest rates start to rise. See, that's when all the chickens come home to roost. That's when the Fed is forced between shooting interest rates way up and bringing on a much worse recession than anything we've experienced, right? That's where the Fed comes and says, okay, now we really have to put on the brakes. We have to take the punch bowl away. We have to go cold turkey and just let the government deal with the deficit, let them default, let the government admit they can't make the Social Security payments, let housing prices fail, let banks fail, let it all happen, much worse than it would have happened a couple of years ago if they let it happen, or accommodate it all and we have runaway inflation, which is even worse. When is that day going to start? Is that 2 months away? Is it 6 months away? Is it 2 years away? That I don't know. All right. There's no way for me to know that. But I know that day of reckoning is coming. And in the scheme of things, it's coming very soon. All right. This is not something that's going to happen in 20 years or 30 years. I don't even think we have 5 years. It's going to happen soon. All right. But exactly how soon, I don't know, because there's all kinds of factors beyond my control. And much of it depends on foreigners. How much support will China give us? How much support will Japan? How long will the world artificially prop us up to try to delay whatever they think the pain is for their economy? So, I don't know the answer to this question, but we will know soon enough. I can promise you that.
And one other question is, when the dollar collapses, what business or industry would you go into, or what do you see the opportunities are when that happens?
Well, a lot of it depends on what the government does. I mean, if we become a complete totalitarian society, I mean, if that's what happens, if we're a centrally planned economy, if the government keeps responding, I don't know if there's going to be any business that makes sense going into in this country. You might have to leave the country if you want to have a viable business. But assuming that we get religion, and we, cut government spending so we can cut taxes and repeal regulations, then, there'll be a whole bunch of businesses. I thought originally, some of the businesses that would do well would be like pawn shops. If you're involved in, CERT repairs, right now, if your TV breaks, you just buy a new one. Well, that's not going to happen. So people are going to start repairing things. And I don't even know if there's many TV repairmen anymore, or people that repair washer dryers or dishwashers. So I think people that repair things, automobile mechanics, because people aren't going to be buying new cars, they're going to be fixing their cars. If you can be a tailor, people are going to be sewing things and, seamstresses and making stuff. And if you have thrift stores or, help recycling things, I mean, things that, will do well in a falling standard of living as Americans are getting poor. Maybe if you have a business of helping people, plant their own home gardens, because people are going to be doing that. More people are going to be growing vegetables, our standard of living is going to fall. And so businesses that help make the transition from a wealthier economy to a poorer economy, Ultimately, we're going to have to be producing again and manufacturing and exporting. And so those are the industries that you want to look at. And of course, I think if you can learn foreign languages, if you can learn Mandarin or things like that, I get into a lot of this, in my book, A Little Book of Bull Moves, which, by the way, if you never bought my book, The Little Book of Bull Moves in a Bear Market, we have a new version of the book. Called A Little Book of Bull Moves. They re-released it. They got a new cover, a slightly different title. There's a little bit of extra text. We've updated it. It's not as big an update as Crash Proof 2.0 from Crash Proof. So if you bought the original little book, there's really no reason to buy this book unless you just want to have an extra copy or give one to a friend. So don't buy it if you're expecting a lot of revisions. But if you never bought the book, then here's an opportunity to buy the revised edition. It's been updated. It's got some new material. But I address some of this stuff in that book.
so much, Peter. And
all right, thanks for the call.
Looking forward to you running as a libertarian in 2012. I'm a former Republican converted to a libertarian, so.
Yeah, well, I have a lot of sympathy with the libertarians. The problem is, you know, it's very, as hard as it was for me to get votes as a Republican, it'd be even harder, you know, as a libertarian. You know, although you would think from the media coverage I got that I was running as a libertarian, because they certainly didn't show me. But at least I got into the one debate that Linda McMahon had. And actually, if you want to see the only debate that we had, it is up on the internet on, you know, and you can see it. It was about 6 months ago. And of course, she refused to debate me. And that didn't even make it as a national story. Anyway, thanks very much for the call.
Thanks.
Next up is Harold in Florida. Go ahead, Harold.
Hey, Peter, how are you doing? I was at the party last night, briefly met you. I liked your speech. That was good. I went around the room and spoke to people. They're a really good group of people. It looked like they're all like junior economists and such. One person, and I've got two questions. First question, just very briefly. One person, when I mentioned I'd been posting notes on YouTube to promote your site and encourage people to help us calling, I said I'd post it to Milton Friedman website, and I got a pretty negative reaction, like he's a monetarist. So the very brief question, what's a monetarist? Why is it bad? Because I thought he was a free market guy.
Yeah, and Milton Friedman, I agree with Milton Friedman on just about everything except when he starts talking about money. Milton Friedman believes that the government should create a certain amount of inflation and that money supply should grow by a certain amount each year so that we have a price stability or inflation at a relatively low rate. And, you know, I don't believe that. I don't believe the government should be targeting an expansion of money to create a positive rate of inflation.
Right. So we should
price stability. You know, I mean, everything else, Milton Friedman, I think, is got it right on. OK, except when he starts talking about money. There I have a difference of opinion, although he understands what inflation is. He correctly understands that it's an expansion of the money supply. He just thinks that we need to have a certain amount of inflation created by the Fed. And I disagree.
OK, my real question is, what is the situation with money leaving the United States? Let's say you want to invest overseas, establish an account overseas, do whatever. Are there controls yet on that, or do you just have to inform the government? And what will happen?
Well,
The other part of the question is, if the government starts putting controls on what can leave, won't that restrict what's going to come in? Won't people be afraid to invest if they know they can't get the money out again?
Well, the government wants people sending their money here, but people would be smart. If I was a foreigner, I would be worried about sending money here because it might be seized. You're right. Right now, Americans are allowed to send their money abroad. It just has to be reported, although very few financial institutions will accept it now because the government has made it very difficult. So the U.S. is making it difficult for Americans to send their money abroad. My feeling is eventually they will make it impossible or illegal. So we are already moving in that direction. And the controls that we have, you know, one of the things that they did recently in this health care bill is they slipped in this, and nobody else call in because I got two more callers and I'll barely have enough time. They slipped into this health care bill a provision so that anybody who spends $600 anywhere, the seller of the merchandise, whether it's gold coins or a sofa, a washer dryer, a watch, you know, a suit of clothes, whoever sells you that merchandise has to file with the IRS at 1099 and let them know that you made that purchase. Now, why are they doing this? Because they want to track everything that we do, every time we buy something, and they want to run it through a computer and jive it with our tax returns to see if what we're spending jives with what we're reporting as income so they can go after us more for tax evasion. So the government is putting more and more controls on everything we do and finding different ways to turn every American into a spy on every other American and layering the economy with more and more costs of all the paperwork to spy on each other. And this is what's happening. I mean, we are, you know, this George Orwell wrote the book 1984. You know, he was a little early. You know, maybe it's 2014. Whatever it is, but we are arriving at the Orwellian society, just not quite, you know, on schedule. But
okay.
Anyway, thank you for your call.
Okay, thanks. Bye.
Next up will be Philip in Canada. Go ahead.
Hello, Peter. Thanks for taking my call.
Thanks for calling.
Yeah, I've got a question about the supply of gold. gold mine production on a worldwide scale has been declining for about the last 10 years. And I want to relate that to the concept of peak oil. And I know there's no end of discussion on the topic of peak oil. But has world gold mine production, or even the crust of the earth, one might say, reached the point of peak gold?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I do believe that the world over the last 20 years or 30 years has underinvested in mining, particularly when gold was in a bear market from 1980 through 2000, particularly from 1990 to 2000 when we had a stock market bubble and, you know, most gold stocks were turning into internet companies. So we've underinvested, and the world underowns gold. Central banks don't own enough gold. The percentage of gold as a component of reserves is at record lows. So central banks need to buy gold. Individuals around the world don't own enough gold. So we need more gold, and we don't have the supply. So, I mean, that is why I am so bullish. I mean, and even as I mentioned that earlier video trying to poke fun at me, I mean, looking at various gold stocks that I had recommended on TV, whatever they were, you know, when I'm recommending a gold stock, I don't have a six-month time horizon or a one-year or two-year. I think the price of gold is going to go ballistic, and I think these stocks are going to go through the roof. And so I recommend them, and I'm not putting – I don't know when they're going to go up. I just think they're going to go way up. Now, of course, I could be wrong, and I admit that. If I'm wrong, if gold goes down, then these stocks are going to go down, and people who buy them are going to lose money. You know, they are speculative. You're betting on what you think is going to happen. I think the price of gold is going to go way, way up. And I don't care, you know, whether it, what it does in the short run. It doesn't even matter to me. Because let's say there's a stock, and I'm recommending it, and I say, you know, buy it at 20, and it goes to 10. If I think it's going to 100 or 200, you know, does it really matter if it goes to 200? You know, 10 and 20, I mean, those movements there, you're not even going to notice them on a chart. And that's what I think is going to happen, right? It's all my opinion. I could be totally wrong. But if that's my outlook and I'm making investments, I don't care. I'm not trying to time the market. And I've never held myself out as a market timer. I've never said to people, send me money so I can time the market. Now, maybe if I did, maybe if I was trying to time the market, maybe I'd do a good job. I'm not saying that I can't time it or that I'm a lousy timer as opposed to everybody else who might do it. I'm not even trying, right? So it's hard to say, you know, hey, you're not a good market timer when you haven't even tried to time the market. I mean, that's not my goal, right? My goal is a buy and hold long term. Anyway, so and answer your question, I don't know if it's peak gold or not, but I think it's going a lot higher, and that's why I own it, and that's why I own mining stocks.
Right. And
anyway, thanks a lot.
Yeah, thanks.
Thank you. Last caller of the night, Tony from New York. Go ahead.
Hello.
Hey, Tony, you're on the air.
Hey, how you doing? Peter, good. Big fans. My wife and I, big fans of yours, and met you a couple times, have all your books, and we're actually your PAC clients. But my question, I have two quick questions. One is about the housing market, and the way I see it is that it looks like, given all the terrible fundamentals, that it's got only one way to go but down. But given a miraculous pumping of money into the economy, and even if they do succeed in hyperinflating the prices nominally of real estate, well, who's going to be able to buy these houses, especially when utilities are going to go way up? So I just don't see any recovery in housing at this
point.
Well,
that's it. You know, I happen to be watching on Kudlow today this guy, you know, Robert Shiller, who's, you know, okay on some things, but really overrated in my opinion, you know, Case-Shiller Index. But he was saying we need to come up with sophisticated products, mortgage products that protect home buyers from their house going down, that there has to be a way that you can have an insurance product or put so that when you buy a house, if the price goes down, that you're protected and you're paid off. Well, that's impossible. I mean, who's going to write those insurance policies? I mean, and who's going to afford to pay off? And, you know, it's okay if you buy a house and it goes down, if you put a 20% down payment, if you buy a house that you can afford. See, he's trying to figure out we need products to allow real estate prices to be artificially high in case they ever come down. I mean, right. Well, why do we want to maintain artificially high real estate prices in the first place?
Yeah,
the best solution to the real estate problem is to let prices come down to levels that make sense based on a free market. The best solution is for the government to stop subsidizing home ownership. It's for people to buy houses they can afford. with money they can borrow without a government guarantee. But as long as you have Freddie and Fannie, as long as you have these government guarantees and these artificially low rents, rates, real estate prices are going to be in a bubble, and it's always a risk. And there's no way to counteract the damage that the government has already done. And you can't do it with more government, and there's no way the free market can design a fix that will work, right? The only fix is to remove the poison, is to get the government out of the housing market. But they don't want to do that. As I said, they don't have the guts to fess up and admit the damage they've done. It's like a little kid, you know, or they're lying, and instead of admitting it, it's another lie and another lie, and they can never tell the truth until finally they're in so much trouble, you know, and you know, if they would have just fessed up. And this is what our politicians are doing. It's one bad program after another, because they refuse to admit the errors of the program. And so they just compound the problem, make it worse, and eventually the whole thing is going to collapse. And, you know, eventually so it's not in the long term.
So basically the housing market is pretty much in a down market for years to come.
Of course, many years to come.
Look at
other countries that had real estate bubbles. Look at Japan. Look at where real estate prices are compared to the mid-80s. I mean, it's
that's right.
And they didn't have the crazy mortgages that we did. They didn't have the subprime. They didn't have the zero down. We were more reckless and more irresponsible. In real terms, we're going to create a lot of inflation. So at some point, real estate prices nominally are going to rise.
But
I'm confident in real money, in terms of gold. 10 years from now, real estate prices will be much lower than they are now. 10 years from now, much lower. Not even close.
I agree. One other quick question is, we were watching a movie the other day called The Secret of Oz by this guy Bill Still. And he was talking about the gold standard, and he was claiming that the gold standard was one of the reasons why we had the Great Depression and that money.
Not at all.
Yeah, I know. I mean, I read Murray Rothbard's
book. In fact, the gold standard is what kept it from being a lot worse, because at least – there is some discipline placed on the Federal Reserve. The reason that we're going to have something worse than the Great Depression this time is because we're not on the gold standard.
Nothing to back.
And the money printers at the Fed and Congress are free to do all the damage they want. You know, it's like it's a bunch of high school kids at a party without a chaperone. Right? They're going to be a lot more wild than they would be if there was a chaperone. And gold is the chaperone. And anyway, thanks for your call. I appreciate it.
Take care. Bye-bye.
All right. Well, as the hours go very quickly on Wall Street Unspun, and anyway, we just got a couple of minutes left. So I thank everybody for listening. I thank the people for calling. I will probably be doing the show more on a regular basis now that I am not going to have to interrupt my weeks with campaign events. I'm actually looking forward to enjoying a little bit of the summer now and spending more time at work and with my kid. But as I said, who knows if there's more politics in my future. I don't like it. Trust me, I don't like politics at all. But I don't want to see my country collapse either. So it's a difficult choice to make. Anyway, that's it for today. Again, Peter Schiff, Wall Street Unspun. 800-727-7922, 800-727-7922, to talk to a Euro-Pacific Capital broker to find out about our investment strategies and what the risks are and if these ideas are suitable for you. Anyway, take care, everybody, and I will be back again next week. So long.